Welcome, listeners, to a realm where shadows dance and whispers echo. I'm your host, Rick Clifton, and this is Quills and Chills, the podcast that brings you face-to-face with the masterminds behind the macabre. In each episode, we journey into the minds of horror writers and filmmakers to uncover the secrets lurking within their tales of terror. From classic tales to modern nightmares, we'll traverse the corridors of the human psyche and unravel the threads of dread that keep us turning the pages or sitting out there in the dark. Welcome to Quills and Chills. Hello, and welcome back to Quills and Chills. I'm your host, Rick Clifton, and today we are talking with author CJ Cook. CJ is an award-winning poet and novelist. She also teaches creative writing at the University of Glasgow, where she also researches the impact of motherhood on women's writing and also creative writing interventions for mental health. But today, CJ is here to talk to me about her latest book, A Haunting in the Arctic, which is already available in the UK and Canada, and it's available here in the US on February 27th. So welcome to the show, CJ.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into this amazing book, I'd love to do just a little bit about you. So just give us a little bit about yourself.
Certainly. I currently live in Glasgow, as you said, but I'm from Northern Ireland originally, but I've lived away for about 20 years. I live just beside a river here in Scotland and just outside the city of Glasgow. And I teach at the University of Glasgow as well. I have been writing since I was 7, and I am now on my 15th book, not all novels, some poetry collections in there and some academic texts as well. I have a dog called Ralph, who's my writing partner. He always accompanies me when I go away to write. So sometimes when I'm at a crucial point in my writing, I like to get an Airbnb somewhere and just spend a few days thinking about the story. And Ralph likes to come with me. So
that's fantastic. We love Ralph.
Great. He's a good boy.
So I've gone through a little bit of your bio as well. And I mean, where to dive in really, but I was very, very fascinated by one thing that I learned. And that was that in 2020, during the pandemic, you actually set up a virtual literary festival. I would love for you to talk a little bit about that, because I just find it very fascinating, and especially in the pandemic and sort of figuring that out. And, you know, it was just, I thought it was phenomenal.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was such a good moment. Yeah. So as part of my job at the University of Glasgow, I teach creative writing, and we have been teaching distant learning for a long time. And I had spent a long time as the convener of that particular program, thinking about ways to best to deliver creative writing at a distance. And we were using Zoom at a time when no one else sort of was using Zoom, or at least, you know, not, it wasn't as prevalent as it is now. And so when lockdown kicked in, I thought, you know, we really need, we need literature. This is the moment we need books, and we need to try and do it together. And yeah, I floated the idea on Twitter of a literary festival, and it was, you know, it was a serious idea, but I did not expect everyone to be like, yes, we must do this. So I got this massive response to just this little tweet, and a literary organization as well reached out to me and said, we'd love to partner with you on this. And yeah, so sort of having that help really encouraged me as well, that maybe I could do this. And if I wanted to try and do an online festival, which sounds so, I don't know, ancient, because now it's, you know, it's a thing, right? But that came from lockdown, that sort of online communities that we have now, and the way we do things by Zoom. But back then, in the year 2020, it wasn't a thing at all, but it became a thing. And so I put it together in 2 weeks, and there was like 250 wow. writers attached. I just emailed everyone that I knew, or I just put out a call actually and just said, do you want to do stuff? There's no payment, obviously. It's just about bringing people together. No one's being paid in this. It's just we're just getting through this thing. And yeah, we had 15,000 people tune in. over the 2 weeks, and we just had these like amazing events. It was so cool. But we were literally like, this was literally the end of March 2020. So it was really soon, really, really early in the pandemic. And I really saw that this was going to be a thing, which it is now. You know, of course we do online events all the time. And I suppose that was, it's always been at the back of my mind that once we had the technology, before Zoom, I think we used something called BlueJeans, and then we had Cisco. But nonetheless, you know, once we had Zoom, I thought, wow, this just opens up the world. It really just provided an opportunity, because I was thinking also of folks who can't always attend literary events. I was thinking of people who maybe don't even feel comfortable. They don't feel part of that scene, but they would, you know, turn it or tune into an online event. It just opens up so much possibility for people who have caring responsibilities, who have, you know, work, who want to attend something at a distance, as we know. So yeah, it was brilliant.
I have to say, it is amazing that what we're coming up on 4 years now from that. And like you said, in the early days of the pandemic, sure, we had these abilities to, meet remotely and things like that, but it really wasn't something that happened until we had to figure it out. And like you, for work, I won't go into the details of it, but we had working from home, I had to figure out a whole new pipeline and how to do that. And Zoom was a very integral part of that for us as well. It really did change the world.
It did. It really did. But I was very conscious of, you know, of people who, even before lockdown, this is their life, that they, you know, they can't get out and necessarily attend things. I think it was also just, you know, my motherhood project that I'd done was really about that. We did a lot of live events as part of that motherhood thing, but you know, a lot of the time the women that I wanted to reach maybe weren't there because they couldn't necessarily be there, or they. So yeah, there's a lot of ways in which I see this as being a really great thing for people who just haven't been able to access literature. Everyone needs to access literature. That's my feeling.
I agree with that statement wholeheartedly. I have been an avid reader since age seven, same as you, 7 or 8. And books are just such an incredible avenue for the imagination. It's fantastic, which is a great segue to my next question for you. As someone who shares a passion for horror, I'm kind of always intrigued by the individual paths that people arrive at this genre. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about what sparked your journey into the world of writing horror.
I think that journey starts way young for me. Really, really. Yeah, the same as you. So it's funny because, so when I was little, back in the dark ages when Netflix didn't exist, and you know, you didn't have Kindle or anything like that. We just had a library at the bottom of the road, but we also had a thing called The Storyteller, and it was this subscription service that I remember going and collecting it from the corner store, where you would get I guess a magazine we'd call it, and a cassette tape. And there would be all these amazing stories every 2 weeks to listen to. But they were, I mean, these stories have stayed with me. But it's funny because they are quite dark for children's stories. There was a Japanese story on there about the goblin cat. And I played it to my 11-year-old one night. And it's this Japanese folk tale of this child who takes refuge in this old dwelling in Japan, and the goblin rat comes. But because the child has drawn all these paintings on the walls of cats, the cats come when the goblin rat comes and protect the boy. But it's really quite scary, and it's a horror story actually. But I was listening to this when I was like six. And you know, I think that as Gen X kids, maybe we were exposed to stuff. I don't know, but my children were like, "Oh, this is, you know, my youngest is 11, and she was like, this is horrific. I don't think I'm going to be able to sleep." And she was, you know, deeply traumatized by the story. But this was just the sort of normal stuff. I didn't even see it as horror. I was like, "But it's just a story." So anyway, I think I was always That was always my inclination. And I did try and write more less horror genre, but I wrote a book called The Nesting a few years ago, and yeah, my editor, the first draft I submitted wasn't so, it wasn't so gothic, it wasn't so horror, but my editor spotted that I was sort of holding back, and she encouraged me to sort of lean into that genre. So yeah, that's what I did, and I enjoyed it very much. So I think it's about a sort of natural inclination.
Yeah, thank God for a great editor, right? And that can sort of spot that and pull
Yeah.
that out of you. It's fantastic.
I think
Well,
also just, I was going to say that sometimes, I think right now we're having a bit of a moment, and sometimes it's about the moment you're writing in. Whenever something's not trending, they maybe want you to sort of tone it down and lean more one way or another. But I think I just had a moment where the sort of natural way that I tend to write was, yeah, it was becoming more mainstream perhaps. So, yeah.
well, what's interesting to me is your approach to it through trauma and how you arrive at it. And to me, that's what I think spoke to me the most. And, that's also a great segue. We'll talk about, now let's talk about this book, A Haunting in the Arctic. Before we dive in, how about just give us sort of a brief overview of what the book is about and maybe a little inspiration about what led you to craft this specific narrative?
Yeah, so A Haunting in the Arctic has two timelines. One is in 1901, and the other is in the present day. And the 1901 narrative begins in Dundee, which is on the east coast of Scotland, and that was the site of the one of the major ports of the UK whaling industry. And has a huge history where boats would go out from Dundee to Greenland, and they would spend sometimes 9 months at sea whaling. And I was really, really fascinated with that history. But that narrative, we follow one of the boats that leaves from Dundee to Greenland, but there is someone on board who should not be on board that boat, and it's a woman, whereas the crew is mainly it's men. The 2023 narrative is set in Iceland, and we are with a group of urban explorers who are scoping out the shipwreck of the boat that we've witnessed departing from Dundee in 1901. So they have heard that it's haunted, and they are there to record their exploration. So those are the two narratives, and it involves, in one case, we follow the person who is on board the 1901 ship, Dominique, and in the present day narrative, Nikki is our urban explorer who is troubled and who is exploring the woman she keeps seeing appearing in this desolate Arctic landscape.
I think one of my favorite aspects of the book is how you just move so effortlessly back and forth in the timeline. And I remember when I first started reading it, the first couple of chapters, I'm like, all right, just to make sure I can keep this straight in my head, I would announce out loud where I am in the timeline. Like, okay, now we're back in 1901. Now we're in 2023, just so I could kind of keep it straight. And what I found is by like the third chapter, I didn't need to do that. It was just so effortlessly done. Can't say that word
Oh,
10
that's
times.
good.
And
Thank you.
I just really love that. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to sort of crafting these two storylines across the timelines and how you intertwine them without, without obviously without spoilers, but
Yeah, certainly. So I'm really, really fascinated by the relationship between past and present. And I think I was really, really invested here, making sure there was a sort of dialogue between the two, that the reader feels like, that the construction of the novel is thoughtful, that the particular scenes that we're seeing are both to move each individual story forward, but also there's a kind of communication between the two time zones. So I probably should, when I'm attempting one of these sort of novels that have two timelines, I should probably just write one after the other, but I always just plunge in and do both at the same time. But it's quite a messy way to write, but I think it's essential to enable that communication between the two time zones or the two timelines to take place. But it's a very sort of messy way of writing, I think. But yeah, I had to jump back and forth myself, which again is maybe not such a bad thing because that's exactly what the reader's doing.
Right. I thought it was maybe it worked. Maybe it was a better way of approaching it because it felt seamless to me. Like I said, it wasn't confusing at all. And it worked for
Well,
me
that's
anyway, for my little brain.
good. That's good.
So another one of my sort of fascinations or things that I sort of become a little obsessed with are names and, in a sense, I guess, etymology in a way. And it's the name of the ship for me that really sort of jumped out. And I was like, oh my God, that's so fascinating. And especially within the scope of the story. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the ship itself, how you came about the name and its meaning.
Yeah, so the ship is a whaling ship and it's called the Ormen, which means serpent in Old Norse. And I just felt that this was the imagery that was in my head. I'm just fascinated anyway with all things Scandinavia. And of course the serpent is a really important symbol for Nordic countries and culture. And I also felt that there was a sort of practical reason for that name as well, because it has to kind of snake through the ice. It's so interesting as well, researching the sort of the Arctic in 1901 and the Arctic now are two different places really. They would have been traveling on a ship that was, gonna it was half it had to be double hulled in order to cope with the sort of ice burden, whereas now that passage can be sailed, by any boat really. You don't have the ice that you have now. But I did a lot of research for this whaling ship. I really actually felt for a long time I couldn't even begin writing until I sort of had certain facts really that I knew them by heart, that I understood exactly how the ship was made, what kind of features it had, and made sure that this was sort of all tallying to what was factual at the time.
I was really impressed by the amount of research that went into the writing of this book. I read through your author's notes at the end, and wow, that was just a lot that you put into the research of the story. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about that process and what your research and development phase was for this book.
Certainly. Yeah, I found with this book there was a ton of research to do. And the more research I did and became fascinated by, the more it impacted how I knew I wanted to tell a story. So I think originally I hadn't expected to actually write the past narrative. I didn't see it as being a kind of 50-50 split between the 1901 narrative and the 2023 narrative. But when I was thinking about the ship, the shipwreck that the urban explorers visited in Iceland, I really became fascinated by its past and about the history of whaling, both in the US and the UK. There was very large similarities, I think, worldwide. But also when I looked at Dundee, although Dundee's a relatively small setting in terms of the story, most of it is in Iceland, I just wanted to know more about the city. So yeah, I also really, really struggled to write anything before I knew about the ship and how it was constructed. And because the 1901 narrative is basically set on a ship, I needed to understand, well, who is there? Who are the crew? What are they doing? And that's actually quite, I mean, we do have crew diaries and so on, but to write a novel in a way that tells a story but also is very factually correct. Yeah, it took a lot of concentration and questioning people and reading and then going back and fact checking and so on. So, but it was so interesting as well. And I found I had these weird coincidences. I went to teach at a writing center up in the Highlands of Scotland, and I was teaching a course on Gothic fiction. And it turns out when we sat down to have dinner together as a group that night, it turns out that one of the writers who was there, one of the students, was an expert on whaling and the Inuit and Arctic whaling. And so her job is to go on cruise ships and like give lectures on Greenland. specifically in this period, and I just thought, what are the odds of being sat across the dinner table from someone who knows all the answers to the questions that I have? So that was so good.
That is fantastic. How fortuitous. That is the universe saying this book needed to happen. So.
Oh yeah, it was amazing. I couldn't get over it.
So the book is described by Good Housekeeping as, I'm going to give a direct quote here, it's a ghost story with a perfect mix of propulsive plot and shivers up the spine spookiness. I particularly chose this quote because I think this is exactly how it perfectly sums up the book for me. One thing I absolutely love about this is you start right away with the spooky. From the moment that Dominique walks in and grabs that door handle, it just kicks in, and the chills that went up my spine from that moment, you didn't let go. It stayed that way through the end. So I thought that was pretty fantastic. I'm wondering, without giving too much away, can you tease maybe a pivotal moment or a scene from the book that you think the readers should look forward to?
Oh yeah. Well, there's actually three. I mentioned that there's two timelines in the book, but we do get a glimpse at the period in between when the ship was a whaling ship and then when it becomes a shipwreck. And so for a large chunk of the 20th century, it functions as a research ship. And so we get a little bit of that narrative from about 1973, from when the crew all went missing. And so I would hope that the reader, kind of enjoys that. It is quite ghostly and very much in the horror genre, but I would hope that the reader would enjoy that scene. And I wanted to make use of the setting as much as possible. So there's some scenes in the present day around Iceland and the particular sort of bay that it's set in, which is called Skúmaskot, and that translates as kind of haunted corner. So yeah, I'm hoping that the reader feels chilly in this frozen wasteland of Iceland.
Well, 1973 is really, really, really good. So I agree. That's a really great moment in the story. So I was like, what? What? And it like again did not let go. You just did not let go. So
I think I started writing this book with a lot of questions. So I sort of had an idea of what I wanted. Like I had certain things in my head, like the shipwreck, for example. And I also knew that there was a woman on the ship in 1901, but I didn't know for a while what she was doing there. I was really interested in writing about, women's stories in particular, because the whaling industry was so masculine. It's hard to tell a story about the whaling industry that involves women at all, particularly because they were seen as curses on ships. Like the female body is seen as a curse on a ship. So I knew she was on board, but I didn't know why. And it took a while for that to sort of reveal itself to me.
Nikki's story on the Ormen and the fact that she was basically, I don't want to give too much away, but but I don't know, you do this pretty early on, but she's basically trapped on this ship in a place that she doesn't want to be, and she's experiencing these and it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, but it's psychologically terrifying, I think, in a lot of ways, as well as traumatic. And she is one of the characters that I felt so much for. But all of your characters in this book, I just where this book ends up, I don't want to give too much away. I'm trying to choose my words carefully here, but where this book ends up is such it's such an amazing that ending. Oh my God. Wow. I'll just leave it at that. But let's talk about the characters a little bit. Are there any specific characters for you in the book that you feel sort of a connection to, or any ones that are more memorable to you?
Yeah, I love them all, and it's so interesting because you do, I think you plan what you want them to do for your plot sometimes, and then they just turn around. Like there was one character that is just, Leo is just one. He's one of the characters from the present day narrative, and he's so angry. And I remember writing this character just thinking, what is with this guy? And I think I was really trying to bully him into just being a bit nicer because I didn't know sometimes you worry that if you start writing a character in one way, you're going to have to end up, tying it all together and giving a reason for why they're the way they are. So I kept trying to write that out because I was like, well, I don't understand why he's so angry. But then it's funny because I sort of put a lot of it. Of that anger back in the edits, because the whole first draft, I'm like, I have no idea what is wrong with him. He's just kicking stuff, and he's just so I found that quite interesting. And it always reminds me that this is a creative process, that I'm not doing data entry. It's I can only plan so much that there I have to allow space for certain things to come through, because I was really perplexed with that character. That's why he stands out to me, because I was like, I don't understand what on earth he's so angry about. And then it came together, and yeah,
And
so
boy,
that
did
thank you. Yeah, so I'm pleased that that resonated, or that that worked even, because for quite a while I just kept trying to write him as not angry, but that just ended up being a bit of a disaster. But yeah, I really enjoyed writing Nikki and Dominique, and I love Daverly as well. And the more, I'm glad I actually took time to do so much research into whaling, because it helped me understand a lot more about, the men who were on the ship as well, and the kind of society they inhabited. And from a distance, from time's distance, if you like, we look back at whaling as this really horrific thing. And I didn't want to just have a novel that showed lots of animals being killed at all. I actually love whales, and I'm fascinated by them. But I also understood a lot about that society, that ironically, a lot of what they used to build using every part of the whale, we now use plastic for, which is killing far more than just the whales. So, yeah, it's interesting. It was interesting for me. I didn't want to saturate the novel with my eco-politics, but at the same time, that's sort of where I was coming from when I was thinking about the Arctic.
It was really, really great, really well done. And you do talk about that using every single part of the whale
Yeah.
to some, you use it in such a wonderful, beautiful way. So I'll say
Oh,
that.
thank you. Yeah, that was the intention, but it was definitely food for thought that whaling wasn't just, yeah, they used so much of it, but it was a great cost. But
Right.
it was literally how people had electricity. It's how they could work in the factories. It's how people were able to turn on a lamp at night because of the whales, and because of the men who went out and did this terrible work. So yeah, really brutal times.
So inside the world of horror, I believe, and I've said this ad nauseum, I think that horror itself is often an allegory for life, or it's a mirror on life in a way. I'm curious, with A Haunting in the Arctic, what unique message or experience are you hoping that readers will take away from with this book? Because you do cover many different aspects of the human condition here. So.
Well, so there is a lot of trauma in this book. It definitely touches upon trauma, and it touches upon revenge as well. But I do feel like, there's a redemption at the end, that I suppose I'm really interested in the journey of trauma that is not the triumphant Hollywood ending, that, someone's gone through absolute hell and 2 years later they're all hunky-dory. I think it can take a long, complicated journey to recover from trauma. And I suppose that's the message I was trying to put across, that no, it's not a linear thing, recovery. It's not a quick thing, but it can be a thing, that recovery can happen. And yeah, that might be a surprising takeaway now that you've read the book, but that was at the back of my mind, that I wanted to be real to the story of a someone who's gone through trauma. But that, yeah, it can change you inside out. It can be something that, really shifts your axis or your world off its axis, but it can end up being something that maybe makes you better even. But that journey is not simple.
I think that message came through loud and clear. And what's interesting, and if I'm ever sitting across the table from you at a dinner party, we will dive in and talk all night about this. But what I found very interesting is the levels that it took for that trauma to be processed. And again, I'm being very selective with my words, but the level, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. But the message came through loud and clear. So.
I'm glad about that. It's interesting. I initially had a different opening, and it was a scene with her father making an arrangement that impacted Dominique, shall we say, and really was such a betrayal as well to her. And we ended up taking out that scene, but sometimes I think about it. I think about putting it back in. It gives away a lot of the plot, and that's why we decided not to put it in. But I think there is that kind of, I was thinking about relationships as well, and thinking about, her relationship with her father as well. I hoped that the scene at the beginning now, where she and her father have this conversation, and there's a little bird that sort of symbolizes maybe what's gonna come ahead. I hope that that maybe does it in a lighter way. But yeah, I wanted to tell a story, I suppose, about those different levels of trauma, and about betrayal, and about revenge. Once I found out what she was doing on that ship, it did actually shock me. And I thought, can I write this? Like, can I actually write this story? So I did sort of, tell a few people, my agent, my publisher, obviously, that this is the dealio, this is what happens. And, I wanted to see what they said, but they were quite intrigued, so.
But that actually brings up a really great question for me about maintaining emotional balance and enough distance when writing something like that. How was that process for you? How did you maintain that well-being, your well-being?
I think I've developed a practice over the years that it used to trigger me, and when I would write something that would sort of be close to the bone, or would just be upsetting to write, it would just be a very hard process. And that's why, I suppose, even when I started writing, I thought, can I write this? But I felt compelled to write it. And so I felt like I was able to, but I reckon that if I had tried to do this 10 years ago, I don't think I could have. It would have, played havoc. It would have drained me. And maybe, I remember there was a time when I was writing that I would have nightmares, and sort of things that I was writing about would seep into my dreams. And I still get that, but not as much. So I think that I'm in a space now that I was able to, and I was able to think more about what I wanted to achieve in the larger context of the story. So it's all about, I suppose, where you're at in your own writing process and your own mental well-being, and so on. So this sort of was at the right time for me, that I felt like I could tell this story without it being detrimental in some way to me.
Being mindful of our time here, I will sort of change directions a little bit. And I'll ask you the question that I know everybody asks, but I just love this question because it gives me more fuel for my bookshelves. But what authors or literary voices are capturing your attention right now? Who's filling the pages of your reading list?
Oh, so many. I'm just looking around to see, I have tons of books on my shelves. My kind of go-to writers are Maggie O'Farrell, who just published, she published Hamnet recently, and then The Marriage Portrait, which is just phenomenal. But I read broadly, and I started as a poet, so I've got a lot of poets on my list as well. And Sharon Olds is my go-to. The American poet Sharon Olds is just incredible. And I think actually she, for the longest time, she was doing things in such a courageous way, and writing about topics in this brilliant, brutal way, that it kind of give me permission, I think, to go to dark places in my own work. Because sometimes it can be a hard thing when you think, I will probably turn off a lot of people just by writing about the darkness. But I felt like she just opened that door and held it open, and continues to hold it open for so many people. But yeah, so let me think about who. I'm loving Catherine Ryan Howard at the minute. Hang on, I'm gonna have to have a look at my list, because I've got like so many recommendations. And if I leave people out, I'm gonna be like, so annoyed with myself. I'm reading Araminta Hall's One of the Good Guys. Is that out there? I think it's just fresh out here, and it's such a great, it's not horror, but it's just a really great crime story. Black Feathers, I don't know if you've read that, by Rebecca Natley. It's a really chilling ghost story. I've also been
Gosh.
reading A Haunting in the Hill by Elizabeth Hand.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm talking with Liz next week. So I
Oh,
love
yeah.
that book. Love that book.
Well, one book that I read over Christmas, I'm so glad I just had a quick glance at my download history, but John Langan's The Fisherman. It
Okay.
is absolutely incredible. Now, I think that was published in the States in 2016, but it seems to just be quite recent in terms of its publication in the UK. It is mind-blowing. I don't think I've ever read something like this book. So The Fisherman, definitely one to have on your reading list by John Langan. It's got cosmic horror in it. The ideas that he's working with are just off the charts and brilliant and bold. And yeah, I have quite the book hangover after that one in particular.
I've
Yeah.
got one recommendation for you. It's a book that I just recently finished, Tanya de Rosario. It's a book called Dinner on Monster Island, and it's actually a book of essays. And
Okay.
she talks about her life growing up in Singapore and being gay exorcised at the age of 12 and her relationship with her mother. And it's just a book I could not put down. It's just so captivating. I highly recommend it. It comes
I'm just
out
right
here in
there.
February. So.
February, right. It's on my list. Yeah, I do love books with the weirdness running right through them. What's that book? Stephen Graham Jones? No, it's not right. Yes, it is Stephen Graham Jones, The Only Good Indians. Wow.
Yeah.
That book has stayed with me as well, because I remember listening to it on audiobook, and I'm driving and I'm like, wait, what? Just that I don't want to give it away, but just where the story goes, I had to go back home, replay it, and then I still bought the ebook to check that I was reading correctly, because it was just like, whoa, this story has just taken me somewhere I did not expect. But I do love that. I love when I am just, you have this moment and the story just seizes you and wrenches you into a story that, it's the best feeling. I love when I read someone who's just so, confident and bold in their storytelling that you just don't see it coming.
Yeah, Clay McLeod Chapman was that book for me. What Kind of Mother? The first night I read it, I read probably almost halfway through the book the first night, and then I had to be up. I live in LA, so I had to be somewhere at 8. So you have to get up at 5 to be somewhere at 8.
Yeah.
And so I was like, I have to put the book down. So I put the book down. The next night I come back to it, and the story just goes hard left from where I had left off. And it was the perfect stopping point, but it was exactly the same moment with you. I was like, wait, is this the right book? Is this correct? So yeah,
I've written that down as well.
it's
I love that. I wonder if that's a new kind of name for books that do that. Hard left books that just go. Whoop.
Oh, I love that as a new genre. I love it. Or it's great. Well, CJ, what's next on the horizon for you? What do you have going on?
So I have actually finished the next one, and I'm currently editing that. So that is out in October, and it's called The Book of Witching. It's set in the Orkney Islands at the very top of Scotland, and there are two timelines. There's one in 1594 and 2024. So we have these two stories that are kind of enmeshed, and one of the stories involves an actual witch trial in the Orkney Islands.
Wow.
So
Well, I'm
yeah,
in. Count me in. So,
good. Yeah.
last bonus question. I ask this of everyone. I'm going to put you on the spot here. I'm going to ask you to write a short horror story only using three random words.
Oh my goodness. I have written down it had horns.
Perfect. I
I
love
don't know if that's a
it.
story, but yeah.
It works. It's great. It works. It works. It works.
Add horns and a car story.
So the book is A Haunting in the Arctic. It is available February 27th here in the US, and it's already out on shelves in the UK and Canada. And as we always like to say here at Quills and Chills, please support your local bookstores. CJ, can you tell our audience and our listeners where they can find you on social media?
Certainly. I'm on Instagram as CJ Cook underscore author and on Twitter as just C Jess Cook. And I'm also on Facebook, just CJ Cook. So I have a webpage as well, cjcookauthor.com.
That's awesome. Well, CJ, thank you so much for talking to me today. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
And for the rest of you, we will see you next time. So thanks so much. Thanks for joining me on another episode of Quills and Chills. I hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the mysterious and the haunted. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to support us by subscribing on your preferred podcast platform and leaving us a rating or review, because your feedback helps keep those chills running down both our spines. And feel free to share the show with your favorite fellow horror enthusiasts. Also, if you guys have any spooky stories, strange encounters, or paranormal experiences of your own, I'd love to hear them. Reach out to me on social media or email me at quillsandchillspodcast@gmail.com. Who knows? Your story might end up on a very special episode. Anyway, thanks for listening, and I will see you back here next time on Quills and Chills. Bye, y'all.